From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tim Cahill once suggested to an editor that their magazine start a true adventure series, but he said you should give the tough assignments to wimps, not professional adventurers. Cahill has been writing self-deprecating adventure stories ever since. On today's Fresh Air, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg and other stories. Also, we meet one of the top casting directors in the business. Juliet Taylor cast Dangerous Liaisons, Working Girl, Mississippi Burning, and all of Woody Allen's films since Bananas. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of pianist Russell Sherman playing the music of Franz Liszt. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines how we use and misuse highly charged words such as Holocaust, genocide, and terrorism. That's coming up on Fresh Air. Action and adventure without the gratuitous chest-pounding. That's how Tim Cahill describes his writing. Most of his articles are self-deprecating accounts of his death-defying experiences around the world, in caves, mountains, deserts, rapids, and the deep sea. Cahill is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine and a columnist for Outside. His new collection is called A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. It's a sequel to Jaguars Ripped My Flesh, and yes, there is a story behind these titles. These were the in-house generic names his magazine editors gave his pieces.
A long time ago, about 1976 or so, four of us were charged with the responsibility of coming up with a concept for a magazine that ultimately became Outside Magazine. In talking about the various kinds of stories that we might have in it, I had suggested that it might be a good idea to have a travel adventure story. The other editors disagreed because at that time, travel adventure was the sole province of magazines that might be entitled Adventure for Man or Man's Challenge, Man's Testicle, something like that. And you know the ones. They have an illustration of a woman in an artfully torn blouse. Some guy,
right?
Some guy that needs a shave, and he's you know, he's pulling it through. There's rhinos there, and all the stories in those magazines were entitled "Jaguars Rip My Flesh," or some of them were happening right in the present tense, even as you read them. A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. My thought was that you could actually write a literate outdoor adventure story, and that there was a whole strain in American literature that goes from James Fenimore Cooper through Moby Dick. Huckleberry Finn is an outdoor adventure, Ernest Hemingway, and that strain in American literature was not being well served by the stories in Action for Man. I suggested perhaps we put people out whose first impulse was not to, if they saw a shark, pull out a penknife and do death battle with it, but maybe examine the terror and some of the wonder at the core of that experience. And anyway, the other editors disagreed with me, and so the stories that I wrote early on were always being poked fun at, So this is just my revenge for Harriet, Terry, Michael. this is it. I'm pulling your leg again.
And I'm not the Terry whose leg he's pulling here. It's somebody else.
No. Terry McDonald.
Now, some of the novelists who you referred to, who wrote in the adventure style, didn't have to actually have those adventures themselves. They could sit home and imagine them, whereas you actually have to go on these adventures and risk your neck to bring home the story. In the introduction to your book, you say that the next time interviewers ask you why you take so many risks, you're going to tell them that you think risk is a form of therapy. So I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to explain that.
I think it is. I wrote a book a few years back. It took me called Buried Dreams, and it was an intense look at the psychological maneuverings of a serial killer named John Wayne Gacy, who was convicted of murdering more people than anyone else in American history. After 100 hours of interviews and 3.5 years of working on the thing, I found myself obsessed with the human evil. I found the idea of one more morbid detail was going to send me screaming around the bend. And when I felt myself reach that point, I thought, why don't I go out and risk my life for no very good reason? And I'll tell you what happens. It's true. If you are obsessed with the problem of human evil and you find yourself sleeping badly, looking at people on the street and saying, that's a potential victim, very, very unhealthy ways to think, and you arrange to go diving with sharks in 2 weeks. As 1 week passes, you begin thinking a little bit more about the sharks and a little bit less about the human evil. The day before you get in the water with those sharks, I guarantee you, you are not going to think about anything but sharks. And while you're in the water, there is no thinking. No thinking in the usual sense. You have to act deftly. The sharks are all around you, 360 degrees. You must be very aware and very conscious. And then, when you get out of the water, you find that that focus, that intense focus that you've had on those sharks and on acting deftly has resolved itself into a kind of a euphoria that is a very intense relaxation. I think that you can literally put your life on the line in order to save your soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see what you're saying, although it's not the therapy I would would choose for myself, but
it's not
what you're saying I comprehend.
But not everyone needs to do this kind of therapy. What I'm talking about is very akin to Oriental meditation techniques. Some people can do this, sitting cross-legged in a room on a pillow. Others of us need a little harder bump.
Right. My guest is Tim Cahill. He's an adventure travel writer. He writes for Outside Magazine, and he has a new collection of articles called A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg. Now, one of your last big trips, and you're writing a book about this now, was to travel from the southern tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, to the northern tip of North America, Prudhoe Bay. And you made the Guinness Book of Records. You made the trip in 24 days. The previous record was 56 days. This is a trip of 15,000 miles. And you went with someone who'd already broken long-distance travel records 3 times before. Why did you want to make this trip?
It's the same impulse that drives people to say, well, I'd like to drive Interstate 80 across the United States, get a feeling for it. I wanted to see... I'd been to various places in South America and, of course, North America, and I knew those places very well. And what I wanted was what they would call in the movies an establishing shot. I wanted to see all of the Americas in a month and get a sense for what all the Americas were. I would call this a high-speed travelogue.
What kind of vehicle did you travel in?
It was a GMC Sierra pickup truck. I don't have any advertising relationship with GMC, and so I'm sad to say that the truck performed flawlessly.
What are the tricks to long-distance driving at as high a speed as possible? There was you and another driver. What was your technique for alternating?
It was the coffee technique. It got down to where each person could only drive about 6 hours and then would have to sleep. And when you felt yourself winding down, you woke up the other person, who would get up, make himself a cup of coffee, and about 20 minutes would go by, and then you would feel like driving, and you could drive for 6 hours or so. I must say, though, that that was the only drug that we used it all, caffeine, mm-hmm. on the entire trip. But it's an amazingly, especially the South American varieties of coffee that you can get, it's an amazingly potent drug. And occasionally, my partner Gary Sorby and myself would have coffee parties. Yeah, I think that happened twice or three times on this trip. Yeah, we would both drink coffee together. And since we'd been together in the same truck and gone through... Oh, Lord knows how many stops with very young soldiers with automatic weapons, and you have to convince them that you are actually out here on a mission of Pan-American unity, having a lot of fun, and that they should just let you go. All this stuff was happening while one person was sleeping or one person was awake, and so occasionally we'd have a coffee party and catch up on catch up on the latest death-defying news from the other fellow.
Well, speaking of death-defying news, I'm sure when you were traveling through South America, you had to make a lot of detours to avoid small wars and battles that were going on. And I wonder how it felt when you were making a narrow detour around a war zone, thinking, well, they're having a war, but I'm breaking the Guinness Book of Records. Did you feel that the trip was a little trivial or pointless in the light of the war going on a mile away?
Yeah. I mean, that's an absolute fact. Here we were on a lark and people's lives were at stake. But I'll tell you, when we went to... This thing needs to be set up ahead of time, because the stopwatch starts when you're in the tip of South America and it ends when you're in Prudhoe Bay. You can't say, I got caught 5 days at the border at Nicaragua trying to convince them. So you go to Nicaragua first to set it up. And when we went into the tourist bureau, it took about 3 days to crack this. And what we said is, we're going to drive through all of the Americas. And we would like your cooperation here in Nicaragua to show that it's possible, and to show some semblance of Pan-American unity. And do you know what? They became very, very enthusiastic about the idea. They liked the idea.
So you're saying it didn't seem trivial to them?
It didn't seem trivial to them. No, it seemed to be an expression of Pan-American unity, just as we had said. And... to ease my conscience on the subject even more, we happened to pass through Central America on the day, October 16, 1987, that Oscar Arias was given the Peace Prize. And there was a great feeling of hopefulness and unity in the air at the time.
Well, I have to ask you about your experiences in Death Valley, and this goes back a few years, and there's an article about this in your new book, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. And you went to... What was your goal here in going to Death Valley? You were going from the lowest point to the highest point in the continent, was that it?
Yeah, some people understand that instinctively. I noticed, looking at the map, that in the continental United States, the lowest point is Death Valley, 282 feet below sea level. The highest point is Mount Whitney, about 15,000 feet, a little under. And these places are separated by about 100 miles. Why not walk between them? Some people understand that, some people don't. I thought, well, I'll write an article, and I'll call it Going to Extremes, and I'll try to explain why some people understand it and some people don't. But I ran into some problems, because there were some things I didn't understand about the desert.
Like what?
Well...
The problems were that you nearly died in the desert. But we'll get to that a little bit later. What didn't you understand?
I nearly died in the desert because I didn't understand the desert and I hadn't prepared properly. I didn't understand that it's surrounded, Death Valley is surrounded by mountains. It's a big basin. It wants to be a lake. The sun won't let it be a lake. But when you get to the lowest point and you're walking there, there's just a thin salt crust, and the lake that wants to be there is lurking underneath in the form of hot mud. So it's like walking on crusty snow. You know, it almost holds your weight, and then you crash through. You go up to your knee or up to your thigh in this hot mud. This was extremely uncomfortable and made me feel like a nincompoop anyway, because, you know, I was out there. Secondly, it's not the heat that kills you in the desert. It's not that it gets to be 115 or 120 degrees. It's the ground itself. The Indian word for Death Valley means ground on fire, and the ground itself has been measured at about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that if you fall down, you bake. And the very serious mistake I made was cracking through that mud, that salt crust in the mud, building myself a shelter from the sun. I walked at night and slept during the day, and I built myself a shelter from the sun and slept during the day, and left the wet, muddy boots on the ground on fire, which means they were baked into strange, cruel, unfoot-like shapes. And I had another 100 miles to go.
And your feet were pretty out of shape themselves by that point.
Yeah, the word tenderfoot occurred to me quite often.
Well, I hate to leave you stranded in the middle of the desert like this, but we have to take a short break, and we'll find out what your fate was when we return. Obviously, you lived to tell the story. My guest is Tim Cahill, and he's an action-adventure writer, among other things, and he writes for Outside Magazine, and he has a new collection of articles called A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Okay, Tim Cahill, we left you with shoes that were baked out of shape while your feet were completely swollen out of shape in the middle of Death Valley. How did you ever walk the remaining mileage?
Well, remember back those strange little things on the sides of Buicks? They call them porta vents or something, little holes in the sides of Buicks? I made those in my shoes. I just took a knife and cut my shoes up and continued walking, and strangely enough, the human body is willing to accommodate itself to just about anything. I got so that I walked during the day. This whole trip took about 10 days, during which time I thought about taking things to various extremes and the worth of it, or the non-worth of it. Some people, I think we all start as travel adventurers. I mean, have you ever seen a toddler, of course everybody has, try to climb the sofa, the child falls down, cries, and a little while later gets up and does it again. Some of us learn our lessons, and we become postmen or buyers for Bloomingdale's or what have you, and others of us, myself included, just simply don't learn our lessons, and we keep climbing the sofa and falling down.
Okay, so you got your shoes back in shape, you got your feet back to them, and you were still kind of stranded in the middle of Death Valley. You were eventually discovered by an airplane or a helicopter, I forget which, that bailed you out. But here's what I'm curious about. You had taken a lot of rocks and spelled out okay next to a cabin that you finally found in the middle of Death Valley. And I couldn't figure out why you spelled out okay for a plane passing overhead to see.
Well, there is a signal that means you are absolutely okay that you give to a search and rescue airplane.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I couldn't remember it.
Oh. Oh, you mean there is a signal that says you're okay, but this isn't the one.
I believe it's a right hand in the air. I don't know to this day. I can't recall. But I thought, you know, what if the right hand in the air means we're dying down here? So I figured I better spell it out so that they could see it.
You know what I really related to in your story about Death Valley? You said that during the day, in the middle of the heat and sun, you'd say to yourself, I know I'd just be so happy if only I had some shade and something to drink. But then at night when you'd have some shade and something to drink, there was so much more you yearned for that you still felt completely unsatisfied.
I think that's why people on spiritual quests go to the desert, because it jerks you around in your material wants so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the desert, the first thing, with the sun over you, the late Edward Abbey made me love the desert, but with the sun directly overhead, it's ugly. And as as twilight deepens, it becomes absolutely beautiful. And what happens with your, there's a cycle of wants and needs. And with the sun directly overhead, all you want is shade and water. But as the world becomes beautiful, it expands around you and it shimmers around you in this wonderful deepening purple sensation. You want everything, and it truly gives you something to think about. And that's why I think that through the centuries, spiritual people have gone to the desert.
Well, you know, when you get back from the desert or from the rapids in the Himalayas or from some other natural extreme that you've taken yourself to, and you're home again in the comforts of home, how long does the exhilaration of the adventure last?
I think it lasts all your life. I've been talking about some of these adventures lately, and feel that every time I talk about them, I can feel them again. They're like photographs of friends or families that I can go through, these little stories that I feel in my in my heart and in my mind and see with a visual eye.
You know, one of my favorite stories in your new book, and this is just like a small humiliation type of story, is when you're out, you took a chairlift to the top of a mountain, and you're walking, you take off your clothes, it's a beautiful day, and you're walking all alone, and then what happens?
Well, I'm glad you didn't pick one of the big humiliation stories. Just
I'm a kind interviewer.
Right. I was, this was in Innsbruck, and I don't know if anybody ever else has felt this. I think they have. The idea of standing naked above a town. They were just tiny little Monopoly toy town down there, and I'm standing naked, a man among men, afraid, unafraid, you know, alone. And I hear this, "Faldera, Faldera." It's a bunch of children singing. And I realized that the way I've set myself up, my clothes are across the trail, and I'm lying on a rock in the sun on the other side, and that these are children coming up the mountain, Austrian hikers, and my sense of it was that my body was not one of the wonders of nature that they had come to see. I thought about conditions in Austrian jails. And anyway, I ended up hunching behind a rock that was only slightly bigger than myself, as this little Boy Scout troop of mixed boys and girls, led by a very stout man in lederhosen, came by singing "Faldera, Faldera." And Terry, it took me at least half an hour in a pair of pants before the situation seemed even remotely humorous.
But that's the thing. I'm sure a lot of these stories that you tell don't seem funny at all at the time, yet your writing about them is almost always very funny. I mean, how long does it usually take for a near-death experience to become absolutely hysterical?
It depends on how near it is, but
I mean, being nude in front of these kids wasn't exactly a near-death experience,
no.
But a lot of your other experiences really were.
They truly were, and sometimes I actually write about them. And if I've done my job well, somebody reading the book would experience some of the terror that I experienced, in coming that close.
Do you have another adventure in the works?
Not really.
You're settling down?
Yeah, I'm considering. I have one more book in which an animal will attack me. A jaguar's ripped my flesh, or a wolverine is eating my legs. Sparrows might peck my spleen. I don't know. One more, and then I think I'm retired from the adventure travel game.
Okay, how come?
I have a sense that my luck is running out.
Gee, what makes you think that? I mean, that's a really something you really have to take seriously.
I do. I never worried about things before. I knew I would come through. I knew I would survive. I knew I would overcome the obstacles. And occasionally, these days, I'm beset by doubts. Do you remember Richard Halliburton?
No, I don't.
Richard Halliburton was a adventure travel writer of the late 20s and early 30s. He was, he was in all the newspapers. Daring Dick, they called him. He swam the Hellespont. He was the guy that when they built the Panama Canal, he swam the Panama Canal, and they said he paid for his own tonnage, just as a ship would, 36 cents. Wonderful publicity stunts and things like that. At the age of 39, almost 50 years ago today, Richard Halliburton decided that he was going to sail a Chinese junk all the way from Hong Kong to San Francisco for the San Francisco International Fair. And he vanished in a typhoon. He vanished in a typhoon. And reading biographies of Halliburton, he seemed to realize that his luck was running out. And he really should not have done this one last thing. I don't know how to say it any more clearly than it's a feeling that you have. And my feeling is that I've pushed it just about as far as I want to do it.
So does that mean one last adventure, a few more, or no more?
A few more.
Mm-hmm.
A few more. I I'm a sucker for them. I want to go out. I want to go out and do it. I want to travel. But the essential fact of my life is that I'm a writer. I speak at colleges quite a bit, and a lot of college students come up and say, well, how do I finance a life of travel and adventure? And I have to tell them that the true fact of the matter is that it's not travel and adventure. That's not the reason people read me. It's because I'm a writer and because I enjoy writing, so that if I was confined to my home today, I would have enough material to write for the rest of my life, and I could find it right inside of my home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good luck on your future trips, the few that you plan still on taking, and I thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Tim Cahill, and his new collection is called A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg. You can also read him in Outside Magazine and Rolling Stone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Peter Matheson, his novels and works of nonfiction, address issues of man's relationship to nature. His book, The Snow Leopard, a personal account of climbing in the Himalayas and practicing Buddhism, won the National Book Award. He has a new collection of short stories. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Taxi Driver, Terms of Endearment, Big, Mississippi Burning, Working Girl, and all of Woody Allen's films since Bananas were cast by Juliet Taylor. Coming up, the art of finding the right actor for the part. Also, pianist Russell Sherman believes that Liszt hasn't been taken seriously enough as the innovator that he was. So Sherman has been working to change the popular image of the composer. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of Sherman playing Liszt. And Jeffrey Nunberg offers a linguist's take on how politicians and writers have been using the words terrorism and Holocaust. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. After 9 weeks of negotiations, leaders of the Solidarity Trade Union and the Polish government signed an historic agreement on broad political and economic reforms today. The accord will allow Solidarity to resume legal activities after a 7-year ban and will offer the opposition a place in a newly created Senate. Jane Dobia reports from Warsaw.
The government's chief negotiator, Minister of the Interior Czesław Kiszczak, said the roundtable agreement marked a new chapter in Polish history. He appealed to Polish citizens to actively support the accords, saying public reaction would determine the country's future. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa emphasized the concrete results of the negotiating process, including the legalization of Solidarity. However, he reminded the authorities that there is still enormous distrust toward the new agreement, especially among union activists who came to the roundtable from prisons. On Friday, the Polish parliament will begin discussing all the reforms worked out during the negotiations. By next week, Solidarity could begin the official legalization process, and opposition candidates could begin campaigning for elections scheduled for early June. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
The White House today criticized President Mikhail Gorbachev's speech in Cuba yesterday. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the Soviet leader's deeds do not match his words about not wanting to export revolution. Fitzwater said the U.S. wants the Soviet Union to cut in half its $500 million military aid package to the Nicaraguan government. Gorbachev arrived in London today for talks with Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and other British officials. Costa Rican President Oscar Arias left Washington today praising the Bush administration and criticizing Soviet policies in Central America. NPR's Ann Garrels has details.
President Arias praised the Bush administration for now supporting Central American efforts to resolve the region's problems through diplomacy. He criticized Soviet President Gorbachev for not following the U.S. lead. He said Gorbachev's offer to cut military aid to the Nicaraguan government only if the U.S. ends military assistance to its friends in the region was not enough. Echoing comments by the Bush administration, Arias said Nicaragua is now more powerful than all the Central American countries put together, and he expressed concerns about Nicaragua's continued support for the Salvadoran rebels.
No one talks about cutting the support to the guerrillas in El Salvador. Where do they get the arms from? Not from heaven.
Arias said he had hoped to hear more about this from Gorbachev when he was in Cuba, concluding, I suppose we'll have to wait a little longer. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Comparing the oil spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound to the atomic bomb blast at Hiroshima, a New York judge has imposed up to $1 million bail on former tanker captain Joseph Hazelwood. He surrendered to authorities on Long Island this morning after several days in hiding, since being charged in Alaska for crimes related to the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The bail set by the judge was 40 times greater than the bail requested by the district attorney. In Prince William Sound, workers today successfully refloated the grounded Exxon Valdez. Crews plan to perform temporary repairs before the ship is sent to a boatyard for an overhaul. Exxon had originally planned to have the repairs made in Portland, Oregon, but because of concerns by Oregon's governor that the ship may damage the environment, Exxon says it may now send the tanker to a dry dock in the Far East. The Bush administration today expanded its suspension of imports of semi-automatic weapons. Its first order on March 14th affected 5 types of guns that accounted for 80% of all imported semi-automatic. Today's order takes into account the rest of them. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 7 points to close at 2304.80. Advances led declines 4-3 on a volume of 166 million shares, and the average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 10 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some pianists are identified with specific composers. Arthur Schnabel with Beethoven, Glenn Gould with Bach. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Russell Sherman is currently the greatest champion and interpreter of Franz Liszt's piano music. Lloyd has a review of Sherman's latest Liszt recording.
Russell Sherman recently told the New York Times about his, quote, lifelong battle to reconstitute Liszt as a serious composer. The popular image of Liszt is as the flamboyant, long-haired virtuoso pianist-composer who was to swooning 19th-century audiences what rock stars are today. In fact, maybe Liszt hasn't been taken seriously since the time of his greatest personal fame. But some people, like pianist Russell Sherman, are determined to change that image. Liszt may have been a showman, but he was also an important innovator, a composer who opened up traditional forms, expanded the technical capacities of the piano, and added rainbows of new colors to the keyboard. Liszt may have been the first composer to use tone color as a formal, structural device. This self-consciousness about sound quality is one of the innovative, modern ways Sherman plays Liszt. Like some modern conductors, Pierre Boulez, for example, or Otto Klemperer, Sherman is as interested in letting us hear every inner harmonic voice as he is in socking to us the big tunes. But Sherman's greatest contribution to Liszt playing is that he takes him seriously. He plays Liszt with a virtuosity that is as searching as it is dazzling, and without the usual virtuoso distortions of tempo and dynamics. As a result, the music isn't just to show off. Liszt seems to be expressing real emotions, mulling over real problems. The opening of the B minor sonata, his major piano work, is like the dramatic monologue of a tormented spirit. Russell Sherman's new Liszt album also includes a noble and melancholy Hungarian melody and the sixth of the Soirée de Vienne, one of Liszt's delightful transcriptions, I could have almost said orchestrations, of Schubert piano waltzes. In the 19th century, one of the ways opera became popular was through keyboard transcriptions. If you couldn't go to the opera, you could at least play the big numbers on your own piano. Liszt's operatic fantasies and reminiscences are among his most fascinating work, and Russell Sherman is one of the artists responsible for reviving interest in them. His new album includes the reminiscences of Lucia di Lammermoor and Don Juan, Mozart's Don Giovanni. Don Juan is a masterpiece. Liszt uses only three of Mozart's themes, the seduction duet between Don Giovanni and Zerlina, Don Giovanni's Devil May Care champagne aria, and the ominous, ghostly music for the statue. In Liszt's broad structure, these themes dramatize the central conflict in the opera, the confrontation between personal, sexual freedom, selfhood, and the doomsday voice of supernatural retribution. Sherman plays this as if he, like Liszt, were trying to compress every ramification of Mozart's great opera into the span of 20 minutes. With playing like Sherman's, we'll all have to start taking Liszt seriously.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Russell Sherman will perform at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York on April 28th. This is Fresh Air. Tom Hanks, Glenn Close, Gene Hackman, Sigourney Weaver, Melanie Griffith, and Michelle Pfeiffer were among those actors nominated this year for Academy Awards. They were all chosen for their parts by casting director Juliet Taylor. Her long list of movie credits includes the recent films Dangerous Liaisons, Working Girl, Mississippi Burning, Big, and other films such as The Killing Fields, Terms of Endearment, Taxi Driver, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and 16 Woody Allen movies. Her long association with Woody Allen began on his 1971 film, Bananas. She was the assistant casting director on the film and had just started working in the business.
Right out of college, I went to work with a wonderful casting director named Marion Daugherty, who was really sort of the pioneer of casting directors in the sense that she was the first person who really made it a sort of creative, selective process. And in the old days, it used to be more sort of cattle calls and, you know, grocery lists of actors, the sort of the old studio system. And I worked for her for a number of years, and she was offered a job producing films. And I sort of outstayed everybody. She left. Everybody else left, and I stayed, and I sort of inherited Woody Allen, really. It was, you know, a wonderful gift.
So at what point do you bring an actor or an actress to Woody Allen and say, I think this is the person?
Well, I mean, every time we start on a film, I mean, you know, now after having done 16 films with him, we know a lot of the same people and we sort of have a shorthand in a way. Usually what happens is when he's working on a script, which is over the summer, he'll call and before he's finished it and we'll start talking about the characters that he's writing. And often we'll get sort of an angle, at least, on who our central characters will be by the time the first draft of the script is out, which is in August, usually. He has a, you know, very, very definite pattern of how he shoots films. And we'll settle a certain amount over the telephone or in person, you know, just sort of sitting around. But then, you know, when he does a film that has a larger cast, you know, like Radio Days or even New York Stories, I have to show him, you know, a lot of new people for smaller roles. And then one battle also that I've always sort of waging is trying to get him to use new people in general.
Well, yeah, Woody Allen is a director who has an almost repertory company that
right, which I think
with.
Is great, by the way. I mean, I think it's wonderful that he does. But I do think that it's sort of fun and kind of interesting for him to branch out a little bit. I always am sort of knocking on that door a little bit. You know what I mean?
You don't believe in the big casting call, the cattle call type of casting call. So you just call in a few select people to meet with you for a part. Usually.
Right. And I try to make them all different. I find that a good director is really comes in with not necessarily a lot of strong preconceptions about a role. They'll think they have some ideas about how a role can be played, but that they're really very open-minded when they get there, and they like to be surprised by different ways of playing a part. You know, casting, in addition to obviously solving the problems of who's going to play the roles, I find often is a very interesting process of getting to the heart of the character.
Mm-hmm. When someone comes into your office who you haven't worked with before, what kind of meeting do you have with them? What's the audition like?
Well, I usually sort of operate fairly intuitively. I mean, I have a sense, I think, in just sitting and talking to someone of how charismatic I feel they are, or everybody hits you on some level, right? Who you meet, and some people just sort of make more of an impact than others. Then, of course, after you've met someone who you think is very interesting in some way or very magnetic in some way, you do hope they can follow it up with acting, right? Oftentimes they do, though. They have whatever that is, sort of all the corny expressions that people use, something special about them, something that makes them, you have the feeling they will fill up the screen in some way, just like they do fill up a room when you talk to them.
When you're auditioning somebody, do you, if you're serious about them, you'll have them do a reading?
Yes.
How do you decide what scene is best for them to read?
Well, you know, I mean, I think most scripts there are certain scenes that really sort of jump out as the most telling scenes. You sort of don't want to go for the most sort of emotional moment where someone flings someone across a room or something. I mean, you know what I mean? Because all that does is give in to sort of out of context kind of emotion. I think that oftentimes character revealing quieter scenes work better. Sometimes if a script doesn't have something that's meaty enough in it, I'll pick something from another screenplay and read an actor in that.
Mm-hmm. Is a star ever too big to audition?
Well, they oftentimes that is the case, that they will refuse to read. But I find that if you're working on a film with a good director, and the material is really good, it's surprising how many people will read.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do it not necessarily to prove that they're good or they're not good. They'll do it to prove that they can play a particular character that is a departure from what they've done before.
Is there an example you can think of where that happened?
Yeah, well, Michelle Pfeiffer read for Dangerous Liaison.
Mm-hmm.
And she was already an actress of note.
But this was a different kind of role for her?
It was a different kind of role for her. She'd never done a period piece like that before.
Mm-hmm.
She was, a contemporary actress who didn't have strong stage training, and this was a very theatrical piece.
You cast Taxi Driver, and I assume that Martin Scorsese had already chosen Robert De Niro and Harvey Keitel for the leading role, since he'd worked with them
on
Mean Streets.
Right.
But I assume also that it was you who found Jodie Foster to play the role of the young prostitute.
Well, she was, known. Using her, obviously, in this part was kind of, groundbreaking, but she had already worked and was a pretty amazing child actress at the time.
I don't know if this is a relevant question or not, but did you have to think about whether Jodie Foster was mature enough to handle the role? It was a role with prostitution and violence, and it was a pretty complex role, and I think
I'll
not everybody could handle it.
I'll tell you, this was the biggest part of doing this film. Not whether we felt she could handle it, because she was always a pretty amazing girl, but she's a Californian, and they were not going to let her do it.
The state?
The state was not going to let her do it. And no matter what we did, we promised we'd have a social worker on the set all the time, that she would have this support system. And it was a battle to the end. As a matter of fact, the whole time we were working on the film, I was trying to find a replacement for Jodie Foster if we did not win the litigation.
Have you ever stopped someone on the street and say, you've got a great face, want to be in a movie?
Yep, I have.
Who'd you do that to?
Well, there were these two men, and they were, I would say, about 30 years old, and they were identical twins, and they were just totally goofy-looking identical twins, sort of chinless, and both had the exact same mustache and buck teeth, and they were so goony-looking that I just couldn't believe my eyes. And we were in the middle of casting Stardust Memories, which was, a pretty sort of surreal group of actors, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped them. And it was very funny because they even talked kind of in unison. They finished each other's sentences, too. And they had these little sort of chipmunk voices. They were very sweet guys, actually, and they were thrilled. They were in the movie, and they had a ball.
Even though you're casting them as almost freaks, they were still thrilled?
Well, they weren't freaks. They were kind of adorable. They were more like wooded animals or something, you know. I think they thought it was fun.
Uh-huh.
I think they thought it was fun.
One last question. I've heard from some directors that when they start a movie, the studio gives them a list of bankable stars, and they're given a list of, say, 12 people who they can cast in a certain role. Do you hear much about things like that? Have you ever been in the position of having to do that?
I think that's very true. I think that because I've had the good fortune to work with directors who have a certain amount of clout, that I've experienced less of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
They're let alone a little bit more.
Right.
But I'll tell you, I think it's getting worse. I think it is getting worse. It's been much worse the last couple of years than it had been before. And I think partly, you know, the studios are not run by filmmakers really anymore. They're big companies, and they're run by people who don't know that much about filmmaking. And most of the studio executives seem scared to death half the time. There's a huge turnover. And I do think it's getting worse. It's upsetting. I'm grateful to be here in New York where I don't have to face it every day.
Well, I thank you very much for telling us a little bit about what you do. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Casting director Juliet Taylor. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Lots of news tonight, especially about Haiti. There's been sort of an aftershock coup there. Elements of the army demanding the resignation of General Prosper Avril. Avril survived a weekend coup attempt. He had fired some army officers there. The U.S. has been asking for Haiti to crack down on drug smuggling. Also from Chicago, a report on the victory in the mayor's election there, Richard M. Daley winning. And we'll visit with the Chenille sisters from Ann Arbor, Michigan. They're not really sisters, but they sound like it. And together, on record, they're trying to revive the art of girl group singing.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Engaging in political discourse these days can be like walking through a minefield. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on how to navigate charged territories.
We're in the middle of a potential Holocaust in some of our communities. Those were the words of California Assemblyman Mike Roos, urging legislators to vote for a bill that would ban the sale and possession of assault weapons in the state. This is the kind of situation that puts the word lover to the test. Etymologically speaking, a Holocaust is a burnt sacrifice. Over the centuries, it's come to mean any large-scale destruction by fire. Then, after the Second World War, the word acquired a particular use to refer to the death of 6 million Jews in Hitler's ovens, in which case it's usually spelled with a capital H. It's probably that sense that has led people to use the word to refer to any occasion of widespread death and destruction. Over the past couple of years, I've seen Holocaust applied to the wars and famines in East Africa, the AIDS epidemic, and the massive earthquake in Armenia. Still, a lot of people would prefer to restrict the word to situations where fire plays a role in the destruction. It's okay to talk about a nuclear holocaust, for example, But what's going on in East Africa or East L.A. might be better described as a slaughter, a catastrophe, a massacre, or whatever. The problem is that it seems pedantic to get after somebody for using a word like Holocaust in a loose way, particularly when the events themselves are so terrible. How can you cavil about a word when people are dying? The point's been brought home recently in one of the debates that swirled around the Salman Rushdie affair. A couple of weeks ago, both neoconservative writer Norman Podoritz and New York Times columnist A.M. Rosenthal wrote pieces accusing the writer Christopher Hitchens of hypocrisy for supporting Rushdie. They charged that Hitchens himself had written an article 2 years earlier denying the importance or reality of terrorism. But what Hitchens had actually said in the article was only that the word terrorism has become a propaganda cliché, a description that people apply to any political threats or violence that they disapprove of. And he certainly had a point. The word terrorism is used to cover a literal multitude of sins, from airliner bombings and political kidnappings to armed insurrections, state repression of dissidents and subject populations, and most recently, of course, to the Ayatollah's efforts at literary criticism. It's become a kind of incantation that closes off any discussion, not just with the perpetrators, but about them. This isn't to say that Khomeini's pronouncement is either more or less reprehensible than setting off a bomb in front of a crowded cafe. But it's clearly a different kind of act, and a rather unusual one, a religious leader inciting the murder of a particular individual. To lump the two acts together as simple terrorism is to surrender to mental laziness, and worse, to linguistic blackmail. What's most disturbing about Podoritz and Rosenthal's remarks is the implication that if you refuse to describe the Ayatollah's threats as terrorism, you're somehow apologizing for them. What they're saying, in effect, is that if Hitchens had really felt an appropriate sense of outrage over the threats, he wouldn't be quibbling over terms. There's a temptation to resort to this sort of linguistic blackmail with just about every loaded term of political life: terrorism, genocide, communism, racism, colonialism. But as George Orwell warned, the result is a blurring of distinctions that makes rational discourse impossible. There are times when nitpicking is the highest political duty.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Dada, nihilism, and punk rock. Together they create what rock critic Greil Marcus describes as a secret history of the 20th century. His new book was inspired by the impact of a Sex Pistols record, which starts with the line, "I am an antichrist." Also, rock critic Ken Tucker examines the admiration the English have for American soul music and the inability of many British bands to successfully create the sound themselves. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Pow Wow Highway. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.